Trust is key. Trust brings relationships, and without relationships, you have nothing. You can have the greatest skills in the world, but if you don't have a way to bring those skills to the world through relationships, they're completely useless.
Hey, everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of the KRS Kevin Rose Show. We have some cool stuff coming up. I am working on new podcast introduction music. The music that we have right now is super generic. It was purchased on one of those websites that sells audio loops. I think I probably paid $5 or so for it. So I want to get some more professional music in there. I also want to increase the output of podcasts. So I'd like to get to a kind of twice a month cadence for new shows. We'll see how that goes, though, because I have a child coming in a few weeks, which could throw a wrench in things. But the hope is to do a couple episodes, maybe 2 to 3 per month, with higher quality audio tracks. And yeah, just taking it seriously. It's growing quite a bit, which I want to thank you for. And thank you for sharing these episodes around with friends, because the numbers, the downloads just keep increasing, which is awesome. I've also switched hosts. So for those that you that don't know, there's a few different podcast hosts out there. Most of them are horrible. And I found one that I'm really liking. I have no affiliation with them in terms of I'm not an investor. It's called Simplecast, and they're not paying me to say this, but Simplecast.com. I was actually meeting with one of my buddies over at Apple, and he was saying that was one of their kind of preferred partners. If you're looking for a podcast host, check them out. So let's talk about today's episode. I'm really excited for Robin. So Robin Dreek, he's author of a book called The Code of Trust. Now, Robin was a senior agent at the FBI. He did that for, around 30 or so years. And most recently, he was heading up their counterintelligence behavior analysis program. So you got to imagine that this guy has just had so much experience with building trust with informants and all different types of people throughout his career in the FBI. So you may think, like, why are we covering trust? Trust is really important. So one of the things that I have to do in my job as a venture capitalist is build trust with entrepreneurs. And I've seen this all across the board, whether it be working at Google or finding people like, you know, Elon Musk or Ev Williams to be on the show. You have to build up and create a level of trust before you can work with some of these people. And I think that understanding what trust is, how to build it, is going to help you both professionally, you know, get that next promotion, or if you're trying to convince someone to join your startup or convince a venture capitalist to invest in your startup. Obviously, personally as well, if you're dating someone or going to ask someone to marry you, there has to be a level of trust here. And so it's just really important to understand the underpinnings of all this stuff and how trust is created and how it's formed and how to maintain it. So we go really deep here and cover some different tactics that you can use from everything from kind of like icebreakers. And if you're new to a party, which is something I'm horrible at, to be honest, the thing that I'm really trying to get out of this is figuring out how to navigate meeting new people for the first time. I'm really bad at, you know, especially if I go to a party and I walk in and I really don't know anyone, you see groups of people already forming and having a conversation. I don't know how to go in and join that conversation and have something to talk about right away. And so, you know, I think that's the kind of like inner geek in me that has a hard time with people. Cause it's funny when I talk to people about this, they're like, well, you do these podcasts and you've been on television. Like, it must be easy for you. It must be second nature. And the truth is, it's not. It's really, really difficult for me to have these social interactions. I was very much in my room as a youth, like heads down on the computer, hosting my own bulletin board systems and having all my modems and wires everywhere and building my own computers. And so I was very geeky. So to break out of that shell and actually be able to communicate with people and build trust with them is been something that I've never been taught. It's like little tiny little things that I've picked up along the way, but I've never been able to kind of put them down on paper. And so when I saw this book and I started reading it, there were a lot of things here that made sense and immediately clicked with me. So I want to get into having him on the show, and hopefully you can pick up some insights here and apply them to your own life. But before we get started, I just want to tell you one little quick thing. The only sponsor for this episode is my own newsletter. It's called The Journal. You can check it out, thejournal.email. Sign up there. It's a once a month newsletter where I share with you all of the articles that I'm reading throughout the month. And some of them are really in-depth pieces about health and nutrition and science, some of them about technology. Every once in a while, I throw a review in there. My last episode, I reviewed the new Apple Watch LTE, which I'm actually really loving, but not for the reasons you might think. You can get The Journal. It's really simple. I mean, it's just once a month. So sign up over at thejournal.email and you'll get the last issue that I put out. So the second you sign up, it'll come right to your inbox and you can check it out. That is it. So let's jump into our interview with Robin Dreek, author of The Code of Trust. All right. So I guess the first place to start would be talking about just why trust is so important. And when you are able to create trust with others, you know, what type of benefits do you see?
First, why trust is important. And it's funny, a number of years ago, when I started down the path that we all follow in our own lives and careers, I didn't even realize that's what it was. You know, we start out thinking, all right, I have to have a career. And you start on your first job and you're trying to do things that your assignments and tasks that people are giving you. And you're not really thinking about how to implement it beyond the nuts and bolts of it. And so you kind of muddle through the world. You know, you have some success and you have some failure along the way. And that's, you know, and the same thing with me. You know, I'm a, you know, from my background, you can read, you know, it's the Naval Academy graduate, the Marine Corps officer, FBI, ran our behavioral program. You know, it's the kind of the very typical, you know, in corporate America or in law enforcement or military, the hard charging type A personality. And what really became obvious, besides realizing that I wasn't a natural born leader, you know, and was miserably screwing things up because, you know, when I got out of the Naval Academy, I figured, all right, if your rank and position gives you authority, and so you can just exercise your authority and people will do your will. Not really, especially when you work in my world of counterintelligence and in the FBI, it's a very flat organization in the sense of rank and structure. I mean, yeah, we have it, but at the same time, it's a lot of first name basis types of things. And the individuals we work with on the outside, you know, we partner with, in, whether it's in business or confidential human sources or even potential, you know, trying to recruit spies from other countries. You can't rely on rank and position because no one really cares. And it really comes down to, can you, you know, work and collaborate on mutual projects? And what I started finding was I was getting better at it. I was getting successful. I surrounded myself. I had great mentors and guides that were very good at this. They're very good natural born leaders because that's what it ultimately is. You know, leadership is nothing more than understand what the destination is and inspiring people around you to follow you to it. Through transfers and going down, eventually I left New York City where I started my career in the FBI, and I went to Norfolk and then FBI headquarters. And eventually I went to Quantico when I was running my team, the behavioral team, and also teaching this stuff. I started being put in a position where you had to take this art form I was witnessing and make it that paint by number for people so that you could articulate. I remember, you know, because leadership can be very, very subjective. And I wasn't a natural born leader, so I was learning this art form. And when I actually try to put pen to paper and write articles about it and teach it in a cognitive process rather than a subjective process, I started realizing, wow, in every situation in my entire life, whether it was personal or professional, when I'm trying to, you know, inspire, you know, a potential human being that, you know, to do something patriotic for our country, what was I actually doing strategizing? And what I found is I was strategizing trust. Because people will not take any action for you, with you, or align with you without some semblance of trust in it. And it permeates our entire culture. I mean, even just driving down the highway, you know, you're trusting the person in the other direction not to hit you. Otherwise, they would, you know. And so the higher levels of trust you can get to, the more successful you're going to be at, one, your own prosperity. But more importantly, people trust others that are vested in their prosperity as well. And that's the highest level. I mean, you can have 5 or 10 people that give you 5 or 10%, but I'd rather have 2 or 3 that give me 120%. And the way they're going to do that is because they trust you.
Mm-hmm. And you, this actually, you know, is applied to pretty much everything. Yes. If you think about when you get a promotion in a job, it's because someone is saying, I trust this person to work at it, to operate at a higher level and take this greater step and this bigger position. And everything from marrying someone to dating someone, like there's all trust involved throughout all these different layers. How long do you think, how long does it take to build trust with someone?
It takes as long as the other person says it takes, is the best way to say it. Because trust is totally 100% based on the other person. Some people are very open to trust, and so you can develop it rapidly. Some people are because of their life experiences, they're very reticent to trust, and so it's going to take longer. But when you are the facilitator of trust in relationships and you are the leader, it's about understanding those things and demonstrating patience and also managing your own expectations on the tempo and timing of when it's going to take place.
Yeah, I think that managing your expectations and taking the time, it seems that a lot of people kind of rush into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that that's, you know, I've a good example would be that, you know, when you're working in the tech field, which I do, and you're meeting some of these great CEOs, they're in extremely high demand. Mm-hmm. And every single person is trying to befriend them or get something out of them. And so there's a lot of guards that go up.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that people will oftentimes put up these walls, and it takes a while to break through all of that. Do you find that to be the case?
Absolutely. Unless, I'll backtrack a little bit. Absolutely. Sometimes we are under timelines and constraints with time. And I mean, we all deal with it. But when you are actually including subterfuge and deception in some way and not having transparency as to why, you're going into the realm of manipulation. And when I guarantee you this, if you're discovered to trying to be manipulating things, because manipulators do things for their own well-being and their own prosperity, when you're discovered to be doing that, you're going to have no trust. And so here's how you counter it in situations where you do have a time constraint or you do have limited time with someone. Just have a lot of transparency as to that and to why. Because as soon as you demonstrate transparency, there's trust. You know, my three core things I use for my ends goals and the things I do with every human being to inspire trust is one, healthy, happy relationships. Everything I do will try to foster that healthy, happy relationship. You do that by two, having open, honest communications and transparency. And third, I'm going to make myself an available resource for the prosperity of others with no expectation of reciprocity. When you're doing those three anchors, I guarantee you're going to inspire trust. Now, what you have to exercise is that patience. And if you don't have the ability to exercise patience because of the thing and project you're working on or a time constraint, just have transparency.
Let's just take it a real world example and apply some of those things that you just said. So if I'm going and I want to meet someone, they're you know, a pretty well-known individual, I'm at a conference, something like that, and I want to approach someone, what's the best way to do that?
I have a format I use, and very, very easily I validate a specific non-judgmental validation of a strength, attribute, or action of that individual. And you just can't, hey, I heard you're a world-leading expert in this. Be more specific than that. And if you can't, because of you don't know it or it seems too surface, just you can validate their time. Listen, I know you're an extremely busy man, and here's what I'm going to do. If you have 30 seconds to spare with me right now, I'll tell you a resource I have that I think is going to be really in line with what's important to you. In other words, you start out by validating them, appreciating and validating their time that they're willing to give you. And now the next thing out of your mouth better be something that's important to them. And if you don't know what it is, you better find it out before you engage, because if you're not talking in terms of their priorities, needs, wants, dreams, and aspirations, personal and professional, and what you're going to offer in terms of that, I guarantee you're going to be wasting your time. So do your homework before you engage. And now, if you're placed in a position, I have this all the time, where you have to go talk to someone, you know nothing of their background, do the same thing, and then just state that, hey, listen, I did all I could, but I was placed in a position where I need to have a conversation, as I want to offer you some resources that might be good for you, but I know that you have things that are good for me. Help me understand how I might be able to get some things that are better for you and what you're trying to achieve. And if not, tell me and I'll leave you completely alone.
I love this idea of, it's actually one of your drills in the book of establishing a time constraint.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of just saying to someone that, you know, I know you have limited time. You're respecting and kind of honoring that person for, you know, their time is valuable. So you're saying, you know, do you have 20 seconds? This was actually used on me pretty effectively. There was a friend of mine, this guy, Gary Vaynerchuk, who's pretty famous on the internet, and he wasn't back then, but he came up to me, and I was at a conference, and we finished speaking at the conference, and he said, hey, listen, I know you're into wine, And I just wanted to offer, my dad owns a wine shop. I wanted you to try some of these different bottles where you can learn about wine. I do a podcast about wine. And then he ended up giving me his card and we ended up connecting and he sent me some wine to try out and his podcast at the same time. And it ended up turning into a great yes. friendship. But it was something that he had done the research. He realized that I had an affinity towards wine and I wanted to learn more about it. And it was also very time-bound. So it wasn't like I was just meeting someone and we're going on this 10, 20-minute conversation. It was like, I just want 20 or 30 seconds of your time.
Kevin, he did a lot of things there that were just absolutely fantastic. And this is what I love to do is think about those times in your life when, man, it went really right. We can break it down and give it some labels and meanings, what I call the Green Tundra effect. I have a Toyota Green Tundra, and when I bought it, poof. 300 people in my town must have bought a Tundra because I started seeing them everywhere. We give it that label and meaning. So let's give those things that he did some label and meaning. First of all, he had a time constraint right there. He valued your time, which is perfect. And then he talked in terms of your priorities. One of your high priorities is wine, and he knew that. And so what he did was he made himself an available resource for something that was in terms of your priorities, and he empowered you with choice with it, which is another thing. And hopefully, it sounds like it, he had no expectation of reciprocity. He merely let you know what his priorities were and gave you the choice of whether you wanted to be part of it or not. It's very powerful because here's a great predictor of human behavior, and he exercised it. If you can identify the priorities of individuals, their needs, wants, dreams, and aspirations, in other words, what they do for their own success, and you make yourself an available resource for them to achieve it, I guarantee you they're going to do it.
Yeah.
Just like you did. Why wouldn't you? Because it's all good for you.
Right.
People are very self-serving. And when you can align what's good for the others and then align it with what's good for you, that's what happens with trust and majestic relationships.
So in these encounters, you're making it all about the individual,
absolutely,
right? It has nothing to do about you. Can you talk about your five steps here? Because one of them is suspending the ego. That's your first step here. And that means that, life is about them. It's not about you. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Most books, every book I read on this stuff, as I was getting into it and working on rapport and winning or anything like that, it's always for self-serving methods. Self-serving goals. And what I started realizing was, the sooner you can get over yourself and your title and position, the easier it's going to be. People do not, just think to yourself, do you like to be looked down upon? Do you like to be judged? Do you like to be thought of as lesser than someone else? No one human being does. And so since you don't like it, I guarantee you no one else likes it. And so as soon as you can get over your own sense of vanity, sense of self, sense of everything you're doing is serving you and not others, or even if you think you are serving others, but you're serving yourself first, it's going to undermine the entire process. I always say the code of trust is flawless. The only thing that's going to undermine it is you and your vanity.
I'm curious, give me some examples of people doing this wrong, because I see what to do right. You avoid your ego, you make it about them, you respect their opinions and attitudes. What are some common mistakes that you see people do in these encounters?
There's so many. Remember, the thing that people, I think, do that they forget to do is that third anchor that I talked about a few minutes ago, and that is make yourself an available resource for the prosperity of others with no expectation of reciprocity. In other words, be a resource for others, figure out what's important to them, and make yourself available for them to achieve that with no expectation of reciprocity. That expectation of reciprocity, that's where the ego and vanity comes in. So, say a salesman wants to sell you a car, wants to sell you a service, wants to sell you, something. They might have very good reasons and their product might be fantastic and they have great sales skills and abilities. But if they're thinking really in terms of more for themselves and the profit they're going to make, their gain they're going to make, and they're really focused on winning with you and what they're going to gain from it, people are going to pick up on this, and they always do. I call it the creepy salesman method, because what happens is that when people are very self-serving, they might be saying the right words, which many great people in sales and in business and leadership do. They're saying the right words, but there's something that's just off. And the ancient mammalian brain can pick up on this. In other words, the nonverbals you're giving off, your tenor of voice, your intonation, if your voice cracks or not at a certain time, the emotion, it becomes very incongruent with the words you're saying, and that becomes creepy. So in other words, you have to have it inside that you are actually there for them as a resource for their prosperity and not expectations of reciprocity. And now here's how this works, as I'm sure people now are saying, hey, you're just being a carpet and being walked all over. No, Because the first step in this entire process is, what's your goal? What are you trying to achieve? In other words, you have to have clarity on what the destination is first, because that's what leaders do. They understand the mission, they understand the destination, what you're trying to do. But now as leaders, you let go of it. You don't have to try to achieve it. Just like you don't have to try to see that car you bought. It just pops into your eyesight everywhere it is. You don't have to try to see it because you gave yourself a label and meaning. Same thing with your own goals. Give yourself your label and meaning. Now you got to reverse it. Now you have to think in terms of them. And there's a key phrase I like to think of with this, and to keep the mindset right. People spend most of their lives trying to convince people of things, like trying to convince them to buy this, convince this is in their best interest. And I gave up on that a good couple years ago, because you really can't convince people of anything very successfully. And you might get a couple degrees of buy-in, or they might do it, but then they'll have some buyer's remorse. The thing I think of is in terms of, how can I inspire them to want to? Because if I'm thinking of convincing, I'm thinking of myself. If I'm thinking of inspiration, I'm thinking of them. So if you want to inspire someone to do something, well, I got to understand what's important to them, and I got to make sure I have resources for them to achieve it. And that's what the reversal is.
When you have that eventual ask, or let's just say there's someone that you want to, you know, do business with or whatever it may be, this is something that you punt way down the line then, and just really establish that trust first, which may take multiple encounters. Is that right?
Potentially. It really is up to them. I mean, it's so funny in my line of work, you know, they like, you know, I sell every day. I sell a concept that being a patriot, something good for the country, and I have nothing to reciprocate with most of the time. And so how do you get someone to inspire to want to do that? You have to do a couple things right up front. You got to, you know, be open and honest about it. So like in my first encounters with someone, I'm very open and honest. I really let them know that, hey, I value your time. I don't want to waste your time. Here's my thoughts. You know, I'm curious, what are your thoughts and opinions on X, Y, and Z, and what kind of things you're interested in? I did some research. I looked at the internet. I looked at your website or whatever it is. I see that these are your priorities. Before we got together, I want to let you know that I kind of put together some resources I have to offer you that can help those priorities. And I also saw that things that you have to offer are good for me too. If this is something that you think we could work on together, I'd be happy to do that. If not, please let me know so I don't waste your time anymore. You can do that at the first meeting if you want to. I mean, this is, you know, just because when you have that open and honest and clarity, and you talk in terms of what's good for them, you talk in terms of their priorities, you empower them in choice, you saw thoughts and opinions, and you validated them, every single statement out of your mouth is about them. And I guarantee you this too. Very rarely does everything someone says or write down is about the other person. Because when it is, in situations like that, their brains rewarded them for that engagement with you. So even if they don't want to buy into your product or buy into what you're doing, they really like seeing you. They're going to say good things about you. Then that goes to branding. Again, it's relationships and trust. And so just don't focus on them necessarily. I always think about their whole sphere of influence that they're going to interact with once they break contact with me, and what they're going to think and radiate out about me from that encounter.
Now, I must imagine that you run into all different folks from all different walks of life and in your line of work. And I'm curious, when you run into people, let's just say in a party situation, mm-hmm. or where you don't know anyone, how do you befriend people in a party context? How do you start that initial, like, you haven't had the time to do the research. Mm-hmm. You don't know who they are. You don't know what their hopes and dreams are. And you just want to kick off a casual conversation with them, or one that will hopefully be productive. Like, where do you begin there?
First of all, I immediately will look to people that are already smiling, for one thing, because people who are smiling are already open and feeling comfortable to begin with. So that's a little easier. I'll generally start out with what I call a challenges question. And that is, you know, everyone's got challenges, and it could be, you know, and it can be and using a commonality as well that we've all might have experienced in a short period of time. Say that you're at a reception somewhere and there's bad weather outside. It was raining down, you know, hard downpour, or the food on the buffet is really good, or it's a really hot environment or a little too cool, something that we're all having a shared common experience like. And then you can start out with something as simple as, hey, so what kind of challenges did you have getting here tonight? What kind of challenges, you know, you have in your line of work? What kind of challenges, you know? So I love that challenges question, because when you throw out a challenges question with a commonality that we've all just experienced potentially, as little as it might be, what you're immediately going to get a response to is what's important to them right now. And as soon as you get that, you're going to start discovering those priorities. You're going to start discovering their context of how they see the world. And now you actually have a way to communicate that's important to them.
Mm-hmm. And you get them talking about themselves at the same time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And that notion of talking about yourself, some people think that's self-centered. I use a broader term when that. It's not, you're not talking about yourself. People are actually sharing their those priorities, need, and thoughts and opinions, those needs, wants, dreams, and aspirations, personal, professional, long-term, short-term, and challenges. Yes, that's about yourself, but what we're doing in each of these instances, this is the human condition, you know, the neuroscience is very solid. We're constantly trying to test the environment around us for affiliation. In other words, is it safe for me to survive? You know, if, because ancient tribal man, tribe of 30, 40, 50, it was the first form of social welfare, healthcare. If you were not part of a tribe, the likelihood of you passing on your genetic coding was extremely low. And so we're constantly testing this affiliation, and we're doing it by sharing our thoughts and opinions, our priorities, our challenges, and what we're looking for in return is, do you accept me for who I am? And so now if you understand that and you're seeking those thoughts and opinions from others, and now you're non-judgmentally, here's where that ego suspension comes in again, non-judgmentally accepting those thoughts and opinions and seeking to understand more, their brain is rewarding them and they want to be around you and they trust you more.
One question about the non-judgmental, because when I was reading your book, I thought to myself, like, some of the best conversations I have with friends is when we can kind of debate things out and hash things out and go back and forth. At some point in time, you kind of have to be a little bit judgmental if you don't agree, or how do you navigate those waters?
It depends on what your goal is, and it depends on a relationship you already have. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's unconditional trust and you're both vested in each other unconditionally, which you have with close friends, maybe some colleagues, but very few people, you can actually share open, honest thoughts and opinions about what you think of the world, as long as you're not demonstrating judgment of theirs. And the best way to do this in any situation anyway is if you don't agree with what someone says and you want them to hear your position, the worst thing you can do is say, I don't agree with that at all, and you tell them what you think. Best thing to do is help understand. It's like, wow, I never heard it quite put that way before. Help me understand. How'd you come up with that? And after they're sharing their thoughts and opinions with you, then you say, wow, help me understand this. What do you think about this? And now you're asking thoughts and opinions again about what you already think. Because there's four things you can do. If you want to demonstrate value and affiliation to someone and to get their brain engaging with you, you're going to do these four things. One, you're going to seek thoughts and opinions. Because we do not seek thoughts and opinions with people unless we value them. Because all human beings, we want to be valued. And so if you have a close relationship, as you just described, I guarantee you they value that relationship with you because you do seek their thoughts and opinions. Mm-hmm. And so you're free to share yours without them fearing you're judging them. Second, you're going to talk in terms of their priorities, like we already talked about. Third, you're going to validate them. And even if you disagree with someone, you can if you have that trusting relationship. But if you're seeking to understand their point of view, that's validation. And fourth, mm-hmm. you're going to empower them with choice, because we do not give people choices that unless we accept them and we're affiliated with them in some way and value them.
Yeah, I love that idea of getting them to explain their stance on a deeper level.
Yeah.
I feel like you could both benefit. You know, you'll probably learn something at the same time, which is great.
I haven't had any situation in my life, Kevin, where I work a lot of hooky kooky crazy stuff sometimes where it's easy to judge on the surface. But once you actually take the time to discover who they are as human beings and the things they've been through that drove them to make the choices that they made and have the understanding of the world that they have from their vantage point, there hasn't been one time in my life where I haven't gained tolerance. It doesn't mean that I necessarily agree with them. But tolerance is so important to make that congruence between how you feel about someone and the words come out of your mouth. Because once you have tolerance and understanding, trust is a lot more easier to go.
Yeah, you actually talked about getting people to confess to crimes,
sure.
right? Like you can't really like hammer that out of people. You have
Guaranteed.
To understand their point of view.
Absolutely. I do this with cops. You know, when I do this training for law enforcement, I generally will start out with a room, say it's 50 or 60 law enforcement professionals. I say, how many of you all out there have ever gotten someone to confess? And all their hands go up. And I say, of course. I said, and so why did they confess to you? And then the puzzled silence kind of happens. I said, well, this is easy. Let's think about it. Is it because you sat across the table and you judged what they did? Or it's because you sat across a table and you sought to understand who they were, the choices they made, and then you started to understand what was important to them, their priorities that they have. And then what you did was, did you not make yourself a resource for those options and priorities, as limited as they might be, whether it's a reduced sentence, whether it's to let family and friends know, and they're all shaking, nodding their heads, yes, in agreement. And I said, yeah. So why do we do anything else with anyone else in our lives? You know, it's really simple. So if you can do it with a criminal, so you can inspire him to confess when it's not even in his best interest, all because you didn't judge him and probably he's surrounded by people in their lives that do judge them, and you were a resource for their prosperity, as limited as it might be. It's pretty simple. Why, you know, think about, well, if it works there, why doesn't it work everywhere?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to get to some of your other drills, because I think that you have some just great, at the very end of your book, you go through these 15 drills and there's some great techniques in here. You know, you mentioned, well, we touched on briefly the third party reference technique, right? So that's pointing to different things around and saying, referencing those things as a way to kick off a conversation. Actually, skipping to drill number 5, where you say employ the assistance technique. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So human beings, again, going back, all this stuff goes back to what we crave and desire as human beings. It's why there's no memorization in my mind. There's just an understanding of what we want so we can provide it. So you go back to ancient tribal man, again, that tribe of 30, 40, or 50, we are genetically coded to want to provide assistance at some level. I mean, just a tragedy that went on in Las Vegas today.
Oh, it's brutal.
And what did people do? They provided assistance when confronted with an opportunity, because not only is it a condition of our human behavior, we know it's societally, it's good for us, but our genetics says it is as well. Ancient tribal man, if you didn't provide help or assistance or share food with your neighbor, if you got sick or injured, the likelihood of your prosperity or even surviving goes markedly down. And so anytime you can build in what I call an assistance theme into your narrative of your interaction, the likelihood of them wanting to engage is much better. You got to keep it commensurate to the level of the relationship you have. And that's why assistance is something as simple as a thought, an opinion on something. It might not be assistance for you as either. I've dealt with situations where people do not want to talk to anyone from the government. They hate the government. Mm-hmm. And so I say, well, absolutely. I totally understand you hate the government. What I'm trying to do is provide resources for and assistance for other people like yourself. And so anything you can share with me, I can share with them so it can benefit them.
Interesting.
Yeah. So in other words, it's an assistance theme, but you're assisting someone just like yourself. You're actually not doing anything for me. So that's the power of an assistance theme. It's societally powerful as well as genetically powerful.
What about drill number 7? Don't agree to disagree.
Yeah. Here's one thing I guarantee in life. Human beings have an incessant need to correct others. So anytime you hear something that is off from your opinion, whether it's your morals, ethics, beliefs, your context of how you view a situation, if you want, here's what I guarantee. If you disagree with someone, I guarantee you their shields are up. They're going to be defensive and they're not going to listen to anything out of your mouth. They're going to try to convince you of their way. I always say, if it costs you nothing, either, you know, potentially financially or legally, why are you arguing what you think against theirs? The thing is, don't try to think of convincing them of your point of view. Think in terms of, how can I inspire them to want to listen to my point of view? Mm-hmm. And the first way you're going to do that is definitely by not arguing against what they say or agreeing to disagree. What's that get you? It actually gets you two people that totally disagree.
Yeah, that's a really powerful one. I think that there's so many times where we interact with folks and immediately want to, the second we hear something that doesn't totally jive with our worldview, we immediately want to jump on them and disagree and get into it, right?
Because you're thinking short term. You're thinking of the battle of, I want to win this, and you're not winning anything.
That's right.
All you're leaving is enemy. And if nothing else, even if you don't leave enemies, what kind of branding you're going to have? You know, this guy's going to walk away from this encounter, and he's going to have probably an aggravated day for the rest of the day. And people are going to ask him, so what happened to you today? He's going to say exactly what happened today. I had this conversation with so-and-so, and you know, it's kind of exhausting, kind of worked me out. And you know what? I really, kind of the pain. So now your branding is shot.
Right. One of the things I loved about the book is kind of more the spy FBI stuff, where you talk about crafting your encounters. I thought this was so cool that you could, do you want to talk about this for a second and how you build these encounters and actually when we can apply this stuff to a non kind of FBI context?
You know, there's so many, I know, you know, right in the book, we really overcrafted. We put the Marine Corps, you know, crafting encounter in there, which is an acronym called SMEAC, which is situation, mission, execution, admin and just logistics and coordination. And I mean, there's so many ways just to craft encounters. I mean, in other words, what can you do logistically to make this encounter the best you can for that other person? And so I'm always thinking in terms of location. First of all, you know, what's the best location to get someone's shields down where they feel the most comfortable? I mean, I recently, you know, probably in the last couple of years, you know, I had potential person that could be of good assistance to the United States. And I called him on the phone and I offered him, say, hey, I'd be willing to buy you lunch. I can bring you a cup of coffee or you can swing by my office, whatever's good for you. Because again, I didn't know what the background was. And so I did that. But there's been other cases where we had, where we knew the guy was, back in the old country, him and his dad used to go fishing and their his fondest memories was fishing on a pier with his dad. And so our first contact with him, what we offered him was, hey, how about this? There's this great Starbucks on the fishing wharf down at so-and-so. Why don't we meet down there so we can have a dialogue? Again, that's making it all about him. I also talk in terms of sometimes, the props you wear. In other words, if someone, enjoys, watches or rings or a certain type of clothing, all you're doing when you're doing these things and crafting a counter, you are putting together things and a methodology to demonstrate affiliation, to demonstrate liking, because, the more we see both language that people use and as well as, things around us, environments that demonstrate we have commonality, the better it's going to be. And the real key to this is it's got to be truthful and accurate, because again, we got to honor the code, which is open, honest communication and transparency. I never do things unless they're completely true to who I am. I mean, in the book, I talk about my Star Wars watch I wore to a first meeting with someone, because my Jedi master in the book, his name is Jesse Thorne, says, hey, this guy's got kids. Why don't you wear your Star Wars watch? And I say, yeah, no problem. Well, would I have worn it that day otherwise? Maybe, maybe not. But, my kids have given it to me for Father's Day, and it was something very real to me. So I wore my Star Wars watch, and yep, lo and behold, the guy's like, hey, what's up with that watch? I said, yeah, I wish my wife would intervene on Father's Day's gifts now and then and get me a tie. I get skateboards, pogo sticks, Star Wars watches. so it made it, in other words, what we have now, we have commonality.
It humanizes the conversation a little bit, gives you another point to connect on.
And it's very, very real. Some of my favorite things to ask people, especially if international or cultural, I love asking because they're so fascinating. Like, tell me about some of your favorite family holidays growing up and what kind of foods did you have? Because everyone's got something from their childhood or background that's a tradition. And when you can, and so in other words, there's a commonality. Everyone has a tradition. What's yours? And now we can start sharing those traditions. And when you start registering smells and tastes and those types of things, now our brains are demonstrating affiliation again, because, hey, wow, we do have a lot more in common than I thought.
Yeah, one of the things that I love about this book is it just kind of validates some of the stuff that you might have already been doing.
Yeah.
Great examples. I just did a whiskey tasting with some friends here a couple weeks ago, and I had invited Reid Hoffman, who's the founder of LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to know—
I love them, by the way. They just did a good— I love them. Anyway, keep going.
I know that Reid was into Japanese whiskeys, and he has been collecting them. And so I reached out via email and was like, hey, I happen to have this person in town. They're kind of a sommelier for Japanese whiskey. Would you like to swing by and try some? So it was like, finding that common ground. I hadn't seen Reid in a really long time, and it was truly authentic. Like, it was a thing that we could connect over and share. So it's I think finding things like that, they just feel really natural. And the reading your book was like, I should do more of that.
Yeah, Kevin, you're so accurate on this. So we've been talking about, but there's another word and term I use for it. It's called thoughtfulness. It's a lost art sometimes, because the culture has gotten into gift cards for people. I have found thoughtfulness is one of the most powerful things you can do. Matter of fact, the people that collaborate with me, that we call confidential human sources, which I hate the word, but that are my collaborators that help protect national security. The government doesn't have much money to pay anyone. I don't. I actually know exactly what their likes and interests are. And one of them, it's a similar thing here. You talk about affiliation and bonding. One of my friends is a bourbon drinker. And every time I travel somewhere, I pick up a bottle of bourbon for him because I'm thinking of him. And we got a local bourbon distillery here in Virginia. It's Bowman's Distillery. They're number two in the world now. So I've become fascinated and included an aspect of myself. Why? Because I value the individual, I value the relationship, and those are things that are important to him, and I can demonstrate, liking to him, and I can demonstrate that affiliation. So those things there's so much more power to relationships and trust when you actually can do these sorts of things rather than money or anything else is what's important to them and what are you going to do for them? Absolutely.
Yeah. And I love that it makes you feel good because it is a thoughtful thing and it doesn't have to be expensive.
No.
Like, you know, there was just a week ago, I'll give you another example. I had heard about this beer that had won number one beer in the world. It overtook Pliny the Elder in this like really famous beer list of, you know, top 50 beers of the world.
Right.
And I was able to find a six pack of it at this really specialty store. And it was, you know, $1.75 a bottle or whatever it may be.
Right.
So it wasn't expensive, but they were sold out of it. They had one six pack left and I grabbed it and I brought it over to a friend's house that was having a dinner party. And it was like the hit of the party. Like everyone was like, of course I want to try the number one beer in the world, you know? And it was a really kind of thoughtful thing to bring, but you know, all in all, it was like, you know, $12 out the door, which was pretty amazing. So yeah, I love that type of stuff. And I love that you mentioned gift cards as well, because I make it a point to not buy gift cards that have any written words in them. So it forces me to sit down and actually thoughtfully write out something to someone when it's their birthday or an anniversary or whatever it may be, versus using something that's just pre-printed.
Sure. And then and if you want to escalate it for yourself or challenge for the next year, don't give any gift cards.
Yeah.
Only give a thoughtful gift. That's, I'll tell you what, that'll have a massive impact. It's really rough too. But the only thing I can recommend is go on Amazon and Google some of the things about the person that you know that they like, and you'll get a whole list of things that pop up.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I did want to dig into was how we avoid, you know, there's this idea of thoughtful gifts and doing something that for someone. And then there's also where this can potentially be dangerous and you run into people that are just trying to manipulate with, you know, being just overly flattering someone or just going over the top. Like, how do you avoid that? And how do you think about not being that person? Because I think we all know that person that is just like, you know, they call them like a kiss ass or whatever it may be. What's the difference between that and someone that's being thoughtful and how do you avoid being that person?
Great question. I get it. I get to ask this in a couple multiple ways kind of frequently. So I have thought about it a lot. First off, I get asked, so how do you deal with people that are trying to manipulate you? And I can honestly say I don't ever recall ever anyone trying to manipulate me, because I always assume everyone's going to do things that are acting in their best interest. So when I engage with anyone, I'm automatically assuming you're going to do things that are good for you. And now if you're just using deception with me, because it's easy to see, because you have incongruence between actions and words, then I just choose not to do unhealthy relationships. And so I'll just won't engage. And so see what I mean? There's self-checks in this. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you not come across as trying to be manipulative or anything like this? It's very, very simple to me. Manipulators, what they're trying to do is they're using very broad stroke one-liners. Hey, you did a great job last week. Or, hey, here's some beer for you. As opposed to individuals that are actually inspiring trust and are genuine, they take the time to dive down for the specifics. In other words,
interesting.
Because
so you get really granular on something
absolutely.
Versus being really high level.
Absolutely. Because when you're demonstrating granularity, you're demonstrating that you took time to understand the human being, which is validation. Manipulators, they don't have time. They are on a mission to conquer, and they're on a mission to take advantage of you, and they don't have time to dive deep, because if you're not going to give them what they want like this, they're going to move on rapidly. And so when you take that time for that granularity, it's majestic. I mean, because I do this a lot, and I've never, ever once been accused of being patronizing. And I ask because I'm freakishly obsessed with behavior. Anytime I hear something, I kind of analyze why. And I thought to myself, well, why haven't I ever been accused of being patronizing? And it came about, like you said, that granularity. That's why my opening statement, or most of the time an open statement that I have, especially if it's someone either I haven't met before, it's a new relationship, or even someone that I have met, that I'm going to always try to use is, I call it a specific non-judgmental validation of a strength, attribute, or action. And I use that word specific in there. So that way it's not just a line. It's not just a manipulative tool. It's not just a flattery thing. I don't buy into that at all. It's got to be very specific to the individual.
So that's what you use for an opening statement or opening remark to someone, basically.
Yep.
That's great.
Yeah. And if I don't, now here's a great thing too. If I don't know anything about the individual, then I go back to time. I will validate, and I will be extremely appreciative of the time that they share with me. And I'll do everything I can to honor that time.
That's great advice. One of the things that we haven't talked about is how you deal with a toxic person. I think that we all have people that we work with or run into that tend to be a little bit toxic, and yet you still need to work with trusting them and them trusting you. Like, how do you, I guess one of your drills is how to remove poison from a toxic person. So how do you do that?
I wish there was one way, but there's multiple ways depending on your situation. As I said, well, it depends on a situation. First of all, I'll always try to understand what it is someone's trying to do. A lot of times toxic people don't understand the destination they're walking to. And so their behaviors are very incongruent with them achieving what it is they're trying to achieve. So if I'm dealing with someone that's kind of got a lighter level of toxicity and they're kind of unaware of their impact on others, I generally will simply ask them, so what is it you're actually trying to achieve? Kind of gets them thinking again. And if they actually know what it is they're trying to achieve and know what it is they're trying to go, I merely ask, well, you know, how's this helping you get there? And can I be a resource for you getting there? Again, it gets them thinking about in terms of resources and cause and effect. Now, some people, you have some toxic individuals that are constantly shifting the goals and objectives purposely to keep you off balance, be so they can, you know, be really control freaks and manipulate you and keep you emotionally hijacked. Those types of people, well, one thing is I can predict the behavior because they aren't going to change unless you do something different, because why should they? I call it, you know, everyone knows this. What's the definition of crazy? Same thing again, expecting different results. So you're not going to get a different result with engaging with them. One thing you can do, though, is one, you can start mitigating their behavior by one, not having it affect you. The way I don't let things affect me is I don't listen to how you deliver information to me. I just think about the content. So a phrase I like to use is I don't allow myself to be collateral damage in anyone else's insecurities, because generally toxic people are being toxic because they have insecurities in a certain area. And so a lot of times these insecurities are manifesting themselves through bullying, convincing people of their greatness, name dropping, obsessive compulsive behaviors. All these things are really manifesting in insecurity. So a lot of times they'll try to find out what their insecurities are through these dialogues and conversations and validate those areas for them so they can shut up, basically. Now, if that doesn't work, well, then I'll go into my neutralization plan. And what that is I started talking about a few minutes ago, and that's where I don't let them bother me. And the best I can start doing is not let them impact other people around me. And this has happened in my workplace before, where someone has done something where someone has viewed it as, well, this person wronged you. They did X, Y, and Z to you. And I said, well, that's all right. That's just them. That's who they're being. So people start asking, well, how'd you do that? I said, do what? They said, how'd you not let him bother you? I said, well, why should he? I said, I can count on my one hand about the opinions that matter to me in my life. You know, I got my wife, my kids, my parents. That's about it. Anything else anyone says to me, you know, kind of rolls off me. Now, I listen to their words if the content is valid for what I'm doing. But if it's just the way they're delivering it because of their own insecurities, I don't listen to it.
Yeah, I think you have to look at that as kind of like, you know, sometimes I feel for them because it's a lot of pain coming out.
It is.
You know, when someone is really attacking you in a way, you know, it's not you.
It's them.
It's something that internally they're struggling with, you know, so you just kind of have to have... you feel for them as a human being.
Oh, absolutely. You know, because anytime you can start understanding why people have the behaviors they have, we mentioned earlier, what's that give you? Tolerance. I'm not saying keep yourself in an unhealthy environment. If you have an inability to let it roll off you, then you got to start looking at, you know, a healthier environment. But ultimately, it's not about you. It's the behavior that they're doing. And so don't allow yourself to let you feel worse about yourself, because they're just on a roll. It's just who they're being.
Yeah. I had a friend recently that came to me for some advice that has a really difficult spouse that they had broken up with or divorced. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's a kid at play and things like that. So it's someone that you have to deal with and is not going away, but is extremely difficult. And you don't know if there ever can be trust there again, you know?
But what there can be, though, Kevin, is cause and effect. You know, say you're dealing with someone who's very difficult in that situation. You know, when you start at the ends goal, you know, in a situation like this. So if you and your ex-wife, you know, start with, you know, not trying to figure out, you know, palimony, stop trying to figure out how many hours a week or arguing over who's going to pay for what. Why don't you start at the end? And the end is, would we both agree that being involved in our son's life is important? Is it important for him to have stable relationships in his life? Let's start with the end. Now let's work backwards and see where it is diverging. Again, cause and effect. Because then if something pops up and you're having consternation about it, ask that simple question. You know, how is what we're doing right now helping or hindering providing a healthy, stable environment for our son?
Right.
Cause and effect.
Yeah, that's great. When you're living in, as we all are, just this digital world of communication via SMS and email, is it possible to kind of create trust when you haven't met someone via email? And how do you do that?
Absolutely, there is. It kind of goes back to what I was saying before. As long as everything that you write is in terms of them, and you're demonstrating their value, and you're demonstrating affiliation, it's very easy to do. Matter of fact, it's the same exact format. So here's what I do. I make sure that in every statement I either write in an email or a text, it has to include one of these four elements. And we said it before. I have to make sure at some point I'm seeking their thoughts and opinions in the statement I make. If I can't seek their thoughts and opinions, I got to make sure I'm talking in terms of their priorities. If I'm not talking in terms of their priorities, I have to make sure I'm validating them, seeking to understand. And finally, I have to make sure I'm empowering them with choice. If I'm doing one of those four things and everything I say in a text or an email, that statement is about them, their brain's rewarding them for that, and they feel good about it, and they're going to respond.
And then how often do you feel that you need to keep in touch with someone over email? Like, is it, you know, one of the things that I have a hard time with is I have a bunch of contacts that I lose touch with because over time, you know, we don't see each other face to face. And, you know, is it something where you feel to keep these relationships fresh and to keep trust up, there needs to be some type of interaction between you two over a certain period of time?
No, believe it or not, again, that's another one I get asked frequently, you know, Robin, you know, you're building relationships and trust, you know, what's your manageable number? You know, you must have hundreds. And I go, no, I got, you know, active 5, 10, because what happens is that you're doing two things. As your priorities, your overlapping priorities that started the relationship start diverging a little bit, that's okay, because there's just no current overlapping priorities of what you're both trying to accomplish. And that's totally fine. Now, the beauty of this, though, is if you honor the code of trust and they leave you feeling better for having met you, that these are the ones that you remember. We've had friends in our lives where as soon as you see each other again, it's like there's no time that passed.
Right.
Well, that's because there's trust and value. I mean, Kevin, doing podcasts with great guys like you are exactly the same thing. We form a great dialogue, a great relationship, great mutual respect, and we enjoy the conversation dialogue. Probably won't hear from each other for a while. But all of a sudden, if we do, it's great talking to you again, Kevin. You know, what's been going on? Because you left, you know, having those four elements in place. You know, you left with that trust, you left with a relationship. And so those are the ones that are fantastic, because now you have expanding networks and you're able to crisscross and fade in and out of each other's lives. And also, now from this point on, if you hear of someone needing something or hear someone wants to provide something, your brain's automatically thinking about all these other relationships, even if you haven't talked to them in a while, that you can start making all these linkages. And if you have healthy relationships with all these people, your network of contacts is constantly expanding. That, and it doesn't require massive maintenance. It just requires when you do touch, keep touching to make it about them each time you touch.
Gotcha. So those individual touches need to be very... I just thought through, you know, making sure that you do them in the right way.
And you demonstrate it so perfectly. You know, your guy that likes whiskey, you know, if you haven't seen him in a while, look, I just came across this whiskey thing, thought of you, bam, in and out. Have another touch point, another great interaction, and you fade again. And because, again, you're just demonstrating very specific liking, you're demonstrating thoughtfulness. I have a friend that is a great aficionado of Mark Twain. I haven't seen him in years. And I was going through an airport one day and I bumped into the little counters there selling trinkets and whatnot. And there is a Mark Twain tie for sale. And I bought the tie and I out of the blue, I gave him a call and said, hey, I was thinking of you the other day. I was going through the airport and I saw this Mark Twain tie. And he's like, you got to be kidding me. Those are those moments where you fade in and out. You have overlapping priorities, but as long as each engagement you have with that individual, you're making it about them, you're golden.
Yeah, and that's such a great example of a legitimate caring engagement. You know, I mean, it's clear like there was absolutely no expectation on your end of things.
Oh, absolutely.
Just really, you were thinking about that person, which is great.
Absolutely. And I'm sorry, Ken, the last thing. And what happens that I've noticed in my life is when you're constantly doing that for others, without that expectation, these people start doing it back to you. And if they understand what your priorities are, all of a sudden magic starts happening around you. I mean, I got people that bring stuff to me and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. How'd you even come up with that? I just let go. I mean, I just let the relationships take care of everything in life. I take care of them. They take care of me. It's just a very, very prosperous way to live.
That's great. Well, Robin, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed the book and it was great having you on the show.
Thanks, Kevin. Me too. I appreciate it a lot. Appreciate the opportunity. And hopefully, you know, the audience gets the most important thing out of this is new tools.
Yeah, absolutely. That is it for this episode of The Kevin Rose Show. Once again, a big thanks to Robin Dreek for being on the show. You should check out his book. It is called The Code of Trust. You can pick it up on Amazon, on Kindle. It's also on Audible, which is where I downloaded it and ended up listening while I was running on the treadmill, which is great. A ton of stuff in there that we didn't cover. So get your pen and paper out or your favorite note-taking app, and you'll probably end up having a couple pages of notes like I did. So thanks to Robin for being on the show. Also, if you are a fan of this show, and I'm hoping you are if you've listened this far, if we could ask for one little favor from you, head on over to iTunes, go to the podcast section, search for The Kevin Rose Show, and if you could leave us a 5-star review, that really helps in getting us recommended. So that feeds into their content recommendation engine, and our podcasts start showing up in all different types of places throughout the iTunes app. And we get more listeners, and in turn, we'll have better guests on the show. So that's something you can do to really help us out. Thanks so much, and be well.